Well, first of all, I would like again to take the opportunity to thank the Venerable Children for letting me stay with you here, and I really enjoy every day. And you know, I don't know whether you are aware of this, but Shravasti Abbey is for me the role model. Whenever I give somewhere some talks on monastic communities or speak about it, for me Shravasti Abbey is really something that could function as a model, how it could work in the West for nuns, you know. I have never seen such a good opportunity for nuns to stay. And I really appreciate what you are doing here and the work she's doing. So I really love to see how it's developing here. It's really nice to watch, and so quickly. It's amazing. I really rejoice. So thanks again for being able to stay here. So now you push me to sit on me. I try to avoid. Now you have to deal with me and my broken English. If you don't understand what I say, so then please point out to me. So, yesterday I spoke a little bit about what it means to become a monastic and about renunciation, and I want to continue a little bit on this, why to become a monastic, and on ethical conduct, what it means to practice ethics or ethical conduct. I mean, in general, I think what all of us want to attain is happiness, right? And we want to avoid suffering, and so becoming a monastic means also we all want to attain happiness and want to avoid suffering physically and mentally. And as you know, we have all our ups and downs in our life for periods, or sometimes within one day. Sometimes it's going up, sometimes it's going down. And real long-term happiness is very difficult to find. And I mean, we may sometimes feel that we are suffering, but if we look on it from the Buddhist perspective, I mean, all of us have been born in an upper realm, right? In a realm where you experience happiness. Human rebirth is considered to be in an upper realm, a happy realm, and not a realm of suffering. And I mean, for me, sometimes when I feel sad, I don't know how you are dealing with it, but then I just try to think about people who have more suffering than me. And this always helps to relativize it. You know? I mean, you just need to switch on the TV or look into the newspapers or read the online news and the internet. And I mean, yes, it's true. I mean, the news are manipulated. I'm aware of this. But on the other hand, I mean, the facts are there. I mean, at least conventionally speaking, they are true. And I mean, we have wars going on in the world. I mean, every day so many people are dying in Africa from starving. We have all these crashes, we have these bomb attacks. And I mean, the world is just so full of suffering. People are staying in the hospitals, they get sick, they die every day. And I mean, comparing to this, our small problems we have, I mean, what is it really? I mean, there's nothing really serious. And we are now here sitting, enjoying ourselves and the Dharma, right? So, I mean, we are really in good conditions. So we want to experience this also in future, and we want to experience on the long term and also attain it for other beings. So we have to ask ourselves, what is the cause of happiness? What is the cause of happiness, you know? Yes, no. What is it? Virtuous actions, right. That's it. It's virtue or virtues or wholesome deeds by body, speech and mind, which produce merit. Yeah, so we get all these inference by the good deeds we do. And this is what we call the substantial cause of happiness. So to really have a karmic imprint that creates a rebirth as a human being, or creates a rebirth in a lower realm, the action has to be complete, right? So it means the four factors to complete a karmic action have to be there. This means the jisampajoga tatuk, so the basis, and the intention, and the carrying out, or application, or however you call it in English, and then the completion. Yeah, so these four factors need to be there. This means, for example, if we take the action of killing, so means there has to be a person that will be murdered or killed or executed. Yeah. And then there's the intention, the wish to kill or to execute somebody. And then you have to apply the respective means. This means you use a weapon or you put somebody on an electric chair, right? Probably, or prepare some injections. I have no idea. I just today heard about this execution coming soon and it's causing me really trouble. And then you have the completion means afterwards you feel satisfied that the work is done. So this means a complete action, and whether it's legal or not, according to the law of the country where you are staying, from a Buddhist perspective, it's killing. And everybody who does it, is involved in doing it, or orders to do it, is collecting the karmic seed for rebirth in a lower realm, according to Buddhist view. So this really said. Well, I don't want to go deeper into this case, but just to make clear what are these four factors to complete a karmic action, and also for a new human rebirth, and to meet the Dharma again, the best thing we can do is to take a vow for our own liberation, to take a precept, whether it's a lay precept or a precept of a monastic. By this you have almost the guarantee card to get reborn as a human being and to meet the Dharma again. If not in the next life, then for sure in one of the next lives. Yeah. Depends on what is most strong in your mind at the time of death. So our wholesome deeds lead us to happiness, to real happiness, liberation, or nirvana. So the Sanskrit term nirvana literally means something like blown out or put out, extinguished as a lamp or fire. We also speak about peace from the burning of afflictions, the cessation of afflictive emotions. This is what nirvana means. The Tibetans have translated it with the term nyanledepa. Nyangen is misery or sorrow, trouble, unhappiness, pain, so many possibilities to translate it, yeah. And nyangledepa means to have gone beyond misery, to have gone beyond sorrow, beyond trouble, beyond unhappiness, beyond pain. This is the state we are striving for. In Mahayana, nirvana is understood as Buddhahood, to attain Bodhi, the perfect knowledge of wisdom of a Buddha, also translated as enlightenment. Actually, one of my professors at university, Professor Schmidthausen, he always stressed that this translation enlightenment is philologically speaking not really correct because it has nothing with light in it. Yeah, it comes from the stem but. And but means to perceive. Mm. So what is really involved is wisdom, is insight. Mm. So this is for both, for Buddha and for Bodhi. It comes from the root but, to perceive. And the etymology of sangye, of Buddha, what it means in Tibetan, sangye, has two syllables. The first one, sang, means awakened, and the second one, gye, means to spread. This means one who has awakened from the sleep of ignorance and spread his intellect or wisdom to all objects of knowledge. This means the Buddha perceives all phenomena as they really are. You can also translate sung with whipped out or cleansed away all faults, and gear increased all virtues and all positive qualities. This means Buddha is somebody who has wiped out all his faults, has given up all his faults and increased all good qualities. Yeah? And this is a state we want to attain. And so we Buddhists believe in our potential to make a positive development inside. In Germany, I learned that nowadays pedagogics in the education department, they don't want to get influenced by religions in their means of education. But what they do accept is that there is a potential in everybody of us to become a better human being and to really develop your mind. And this is something everybody wants to support, even in school. So I appreciate this approach, you know, that's very nice. What we refer to it in Buddhism as Buddhahood. Buddha nature, yeah. So this is, we can get the light in again from enlightenment if we want to. There's example, you know, with the light switch. With a dimmer, you call it, yeah, dimmer switch, yeah. To control the intensity of the light. So, you can, with this dimmer, you can increase the brightness, and as more the brightness increases, as more the darkness decreases. Yeah. So, this means by mental purification or by mind training, however you want to translate this term, you can really, by doing virtuous actions, as more virtuous actions you do, as more the darkness of afflictions is decreasing, right? So this is the way how it works. In Tibetan, this mental purification to attain cessation of afflictions, in Sanskrit, shuddhi, means cleansing, purification. So training is a little bit more close to the colloquial, Tibetan colloquial, if you say lojong, this jong, but originally in the Sanskrit it had more the meaning of cleaning and purification. And in Tibetan, the definition for lojong, for mental purification, is to make our mind familiar with, or you can say to train our mind in virtuous positive deeds by body, speech and mind. So this has the two aspects. The one is about all the negative deeds you have done so far. You can get rid of them by using the four powers of the antidote. In short, by regretting our faults and turning away from repeating them again. Mm-hmm. And then we can accumulate a lot of new merits by doing in future just the positive thing more and more. And by this, the brightness is getting more and the darkness is reducing. So, in general, when we want to attain nirvana, peace or ultimate happiness, the common means in all Buddhist traditions are the three trainings, the lapasun, the ethical conduct, sila, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, prajna. So this you find in all Buddhist tradition, this is the same. And it is explained that these three are contained in three baskets, in the Tripitaka. So the three scriptural collections, this is the Vinaya, the Sutra, and the Abhidhamma. I mean, this is at least the traditional way how Tibetans explain it. It's a little bit more complicated, but we are not here in a university class, right? So we are mainly concerned here at the EML with monastic discipline, which you find mainly in the Vinaya, and it's on ethical conduct mainly. And this is where we have to start from and become firm in before we can proceed to further stages of our mental development. In general, there are three kinds of ethical conduct. We have the fundamental ethics, as they are explained in the Vinaya, then the Bodhisattva ethics and the Tantric ethics. So you start usually with the fundamental ethics, means you take a vow for own liberation, whether it's for lay or monastic. And then usually you always have to start with the lay precepts for sure. And then comes the Bodhisattva vow and then the tantric precepts if you receive an initiation in the highest yoga tantra. So for the first one, the fundamental ethics, the most important thing is non-violence, one of the basic concepts of Buddhism. Means not to harm or injure anybody or anything. This is the path of ahimsa, of non-violence. And then when you go into bodhisattva ethics, then you take responsibility to achieve Buddhahood, to fulfill not only your own benefit but also the benefit of others. Means you're fulfilling two purposes, your own and that of others. And this means you really take the responsibility and say, well, I'm going to do it, I'm going to achieve liberation to help all sentient beings. So this is a little bit like whether you go shopping for your own benefit or for a large group. And so the work you have to do is the same, right? Perhaps you have to carry a little bit more if it is for many, but you have to have always in mind when you go shopping that it has to be enough for all the people who come for lunch, right? So this has always to be in the back of your mind, remembering it's not only for me, but it must be enough for all. Yeah? So this is this kind of attitude you develop. And then if you contemplate a lot about the suffering of sentient beings, then your compassion can become so strong that you can't bear it any longer to see them suffering, and you want to attain Buddhahood very fast so that you can help them really quickly to get out of samsara, of the cycle of existence. And for this you take the tantric precepts with this motivation that you want to go very fast. So, but it's said that this path is very dangerous if you don't have a strong and good foundation. So it doesn't really help to start with all these high initiations, and then you may regret after some years noticing that this is a dress or garment much too big for you, and you have to return again to the basics. So better to just start right from the beginning with the basics and then proceed from there. In Tibet, there was this first monastery, Samye, that was founded around 1800-1814, I think, somewhere in the beginning of the 9th century by Guru Padmasambhava. And then there was the first ordination of seven men by Shantarakshita. And this was during the first spread of the Dharma to Tibet. And they had two sections. They had one section for yogis and one section for monastics. So at that time it seemed to be have separate. Either you become a yogi or you become a monk. Yeah? So these were the two possibilities you could choose between. And then later when the Kadampa master Atisha came to Tibet, this was around the 10th, 11th century, he seems to have put more emphasis on the sutra teaching. And he had all the three vows. And he said that with regard to the vow for individual liberation, he was a monk, he's doing quite well. But that I'm not sure whether he said bodhisattva vows are also okay, but I definitely remember that he said that the offenses against the tantric precepts are pouring down on him like rain. So this was even with this big master. So you can imagine for us, very difficult to keep it. And then I think especially masters like Sakya Pandita in the 13th century, but then definitely Rendaba and Tsongkhapa in the 14th century, they more and more combined the sutra and the tantra. And then you can find it in the Lamrim very clearly when you have the training for the persons of small, medium or high capacity, that everybody starts with the same teaching, yeah, and then slowly proceeds. So this is the way we try to go to. And ethical conduct is the foundation just of everything. So this is most important. And when we speak here during the EML about ethical conduct, then it's the ethical conduct in the sense of the Vinaya. And this means to abandon or to give up afflictive emotions and unwholesome deeds by body, speech and mind, which is the antidote against suffering. And as I explained before with the Dhimma, it's connected with the seed of virtue, the substantial cause of happiness. This means, how are you giving up negative deeds? I mean, you first stop it and stop harming others, right? And I mean, if you don't harm others, you're already doing something positive, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. So the light is already getting a little brighter. But then for sure you can actively do more, like not only stop killing somebody or some sentient being, but really rescuing their life. This is even more, and you go to the more positive side, and instead of not stealing, which is already very wholesome and very good to consciously stay away from it, but then you can practice generosity, right? So this you can do on all levels, and this is what we consider to be ethical conduct. The benefit of taking a vow for individual liberation, whether it's a lay precept or a lay vow or a monastic vow, is, as we mentioned before, that it's the karmic cause for attaining human rebirth and meeting the Dharma again. And it's also just the perfect means to accumulate merit. I mean, when I heard that by taking the Pratimoksha vows, these vows for own liberation, you are just collecting merit day and night, I really didn't want to wait one day longer to take it. I was so much in a hurry, so crazy for merit. I think I give my teacher sometimes really difficult time. Even when I asked for monastic precepts, I got it within 10 days, you know, because after I had made the decision I want to become a nun, it was very difficult for me to wait. And my teacher just looked into the calendar. It was the first ordination in our center, so at that time there were not so many regulations of becoming monastic as nowadays, you know. And Tibetans are very much used, if you come and your parents have agreed to everything and so on, so they just proceed, they look into their calendar, when is the next auspicious day according to Tibetan astrology.
I got my day
and my ordination was nice, so I I got it quite quickly without attending any pre-ordination courses and so on, so I got the easy track. And in this case it went well, it not always went well. So taking a vow for individual liberation, most important, as I mentioned yesterday, is renunciation. Very important, the motivation. Tibetan Lamas say, if you don't have this motivation and you don't have this strong wish, I want to get out of the samsara, you will not receive the precept. No. I mean, actually, this, what I said now, precept, but vow. I mean, the Tibetans really use Dompa Samvriti, the vow. And this you find only in the Tibetan tradition, I think. Perhaps it's also in the Chinese canon, but they don't have so much emphasis on this. I'm not so sure about the Dharmagupta tradition, but definitely with Theravadins I had some exchange on this. And they use the term precepts, but they don't have this idea of that really a vow is arising in your continuum. Mm-hmm. But in the Tibetan tradition, you really think when you receive the precepts, mm-hmm. there comes the moment, perhaps even during, at least during the lay ordinations or when you take refuge, they may snip with the finger mm-hmm. and say, now in this moment you think, now I got it, yeah? Mm-hmm. Now it really came into being, and from now on, I'm a lay person, yeah, and now I have these precepts, and then you rejoice, and whenever you remember that you have taken them, rejoice in them, and then the merit's getting even more. So it's something, I mean, which means makes our life really meaningful, because whatever you are doing, whether you are at work, whether you are sleeping, whether you are sick in your bed and can't do anything, but still, as long as you don't break your precepts, I mean, you collect all the time merits, right? It's wonderful. I mean, this means you are practicing day and night just by keeping those precepts. This is a very good opportunity, and we should always rejoice in having this wonderful opportunity. And so, but if we don't keep, I mean, this is also what Tibetan lamas stress. I mean, if you take it and you don't care and you break them and you don't purify them properly and so on, they say these precepts can become really a cause of suffering. And you collect more negative karma if you consciously break a vow than if you haven't taken it. I mean, if you have taken a vow not to kill, and then, let me say it again, so to make sure I don't say it in the wrong way. So if you have taken the vow and you keep it, or the precept, it's very good. You collect merit. But then if you have taken the vow and you break it, then you make more negative karma than if you haven't taken the vow and do some wrong action, you know. Because you have really made this promise, I will not do this, and I'm going to stay away from it. So it's really important, after you have taken the precepts, to keep them well. So to become a monk or nun is quite easy, but really to remain and not to break the precepts is quite difficult. So this is something you have to work on your whole life after you have taken this decision. So such kind of decisions should be taken very carefully, and make sure you get the proper conditions around you that make it more easy to keep them. So then you have this intention to give up faults and offenses, which is the meaning of ethical conduct, and this requires mindfulness. I think you have already these teachings from Venerable Children on mindfulness right now. This is very important in this context. And it's important to reduce desire and distraction. So it's explained that ethical conduct really helps to calm your mind down, that the rough desire gets less. Yeah. And by doing so, you can proceed better to develop concentration and then develop wisdom in your mind. Yeah, but as long as your mind is too much distracted by these outer phenomena, then it's very difficult to develop a stable concentration. So you will have already noticed when you are here, it's much easier to concentrate, and it's much easier to practice ethical conduct than if you are out in the world where you are all the time getting from everywhere so many influences, so many objects changing all the time, yeah? So it's much more difficult. I remember when I was first time in India in 1980, when I was still a laywoman. Then there was a discussion among the Westerners whether it's easier to stay as a monastic in the West or in India. And many felt, well, in the West you get so much spoiled, everything is so luxurious, it's so nice, so this is not real renunciation. Real renunciation is here in India where everything is so poor. So at that time I really felt perhaps they are right, huh? But if I look on it nowadays, I think I stayed 2 winters for my PhD thesis in Sarnath in India. I really enjoyed it, it was very nice. And I think in a way, yes, it's easier to be a nun in India. Yeah, it's more difficult here in the West. I think this outer conditions may be a little bit more pleasant, but really to restrain yourself from all these attractions, yeah, and to get more firm inside is much more difficult here. So if you can remain as a nun in the West, I think you are doing pretty well. So I don't know, we don't need to compete about this, but my teacher always felt that if we want to become monks or nuns, or want to become Buddhists, we should better remain in the place where we are born, and try really to serve society there from the point of Dharma. and not say, because I became a Buddhist, now I have to leave the country, I have to leave everything, I have to go into the mountains. Yeah. So, but really, I mean, remain where you are and try to practice the Dharma in your daily life there, in your community. So, I think this is also reasonable. And we also need to consider when we try to control our desire, what ethical conduct is mainly concerned with, that ethical conduct and desire, they are in our mind, right? It's not in the object. So the point is, just by giving up the objects, there is no insurance that the desire is given up. Yeah, this, I mean, you can only judge from yourself in your mind whether desire is still there or not. I mean, you can think all the time about the things you don't take, right? Like a nice coffee, nice cup of coffee or something like this, which you don't get it, trust me. Starbucks. So, means desire is still there, right? So, what else to say? Yeah, so yeah, the same goes for renunciation. Renunciation is an attitude, right? It's nothing physical, it's not outside. Renunciation is inside. Geshe Lobsang Thakchen says in his Tsongkhapa's Principal Teachings of Buddhism, a prisoner can sit in a jail, but if he never wants to escape, and never really attempts an escape, he never will escape. It's the same for us. If we never try to find some way to escape the cycle of life, the day of our escape will never arrive. If we work to develop the wish to escape, then surely there will come a time when we do. I like this very much. I found yesterday evening one of your books. Wanted to share with you. So, according to the Vinaya, the main problem of staying in this prison is our desire. And the question is, how do you recognize it? Usually it's said that desire is much more subtle than anger. And the comparison that is given is that anger is like fire that burns a piece of paper. And the desire is like oil spreading on some cotton or paper. Yeah. So it's much more subtle, it's much more difficult to recognize. You can recognize whatever afflictions come to your mind because the mind gets unstable and gets nervous or excited. And I mean, a good thing to know whether there's really desire or not is if somebody is taking away from what you just enjoy, whether there's disappointment or not. For example, if you're at home watching TV and suddenly there's a, how do you call this, disturbance, you know, so suddenly it's gone and you can't continue to watch, or something wrong with your DVDs, or you have done wrong taping and you don't get the end, right? If you then get nervous, then you know there's really desire. Or if you have prepared something nice, or you have, for example, you're in your office or you're in a Dharma center and you see a nice piece of cake, and you make on the way some plan and think, well, when I pass there again, I will take this piece of cake and enjoy, and then you come, it's gone. Exactly the one you liked. So then if there's disappointment, you know there's really desire, right? If not, doesn't matter, then you can just enjoy. And I mean, if it's too difficult to renounce all these things at one time, I mean, you have always to make a plan for a long time, right? So I mean, it's easy to do it for some weeks, for some days, or for a certain time, but for all your life, I mean, if you are forcing yourself too hard in the beginning, you may not reach the end. So you want to really, I mean, persist all over your life. So you should give yourself a nice treatment in between. There was this story of this Kadampa Geshe Benkoye, I think, Benkoye, the one who counted his good and bad actions every evening with white and black stones, you know. And if he had done very nicely and had more white stones than black stones, then he served himself some nice butter tea. I love butter tea. And this is a Tibetan specialty. Either you like it or you dislike it. There's nothing in between. And if he hadn't done well, then he just put his cup on, how do you say, upside down, yeah, and he didn't get that evening. So you can give you some nice treatment in between. And what's also a possibility, at least my teacher told me, he said, if you are enjoying some things you still have desire with, then it's good during the time you enjoy it, you contemplate the disadvantages. This is also a nice method, you know. I mean, just to really, while enjoying, also thinking about the disadvantages and why you should renounce from it. So this is also a possibility to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think don't push yourself too much, and be sure you always challenge yourself somewhere to find the middle way, the balance in between. Mm-hmm. There was a question?
Yeah, I mean, can we talk a little bit more about this desire? Because certainly you have to have desire to want the, you know, to be the individual liberation. Or the desire, I mean, desire can't always be bad, because you can have desire to do virtuous actions. Or so.
No, we wouldn't call this desire. We don't call this desire. Desire is always something that leads to. Suffering, yeah. So not to, it's just a question of how you define the words and how you are using the terminology. Mm-hmm. But in the Buddhist terminology, desire means always it's bringing you down. Mm. And I mean, this is also sometimes it occurs that where's the difference between love and desire? And for example, if you fall in love with somebody, some people may think, well, it's actually compassion, it's love, you know. But if it's really love, how can you test whether it's love, real love, or whether it is desire? For example, if you feel close to a person and the person gets sick or old and is in a bad mood, and you feel more and more love for the person, then it may be real love, you know. But if you get lose your interest in the person then more and more, and you want to stay away from it, and you feel somehow no longer well in the presence of the person, you know, then it's a sign that you had just had desire and it was no real love. I mean, I heard from some colleagues at university who are also Buddhist, at least one I remember very clearly, and also second one, they told me that actually they only knew what is real love when their children were born, you know. Mm-hmm. And that they feel that in the Buddhist texts, if the example is given that you love the person like a mother loves her child, that this should also go for fathers, and that this is the real love. So since I had never kids, I can't tell you whether this is true or not. But they were very serious Buddhists, so for a long time. And I think perhaps they are right. It's really, I mean, where's this example coming from? I mean, I mean, you hear very often that parents would give their own life, you know, if they could save the life of the child. So. This is also something important to consider when you consider monastic ordination, whether you really want to renounce the possibility of having a relationship and having kids and so on. So I mean, if you have really decided on this, then it's done, you know, for this life. So I mean, you should really think well about it, whether this is serious, and you really, especially if you are very young, you should really think well about it, whether this is really the way you want to go. So otherwise you may later regret, and if you regret something wholesome, then it's all lost, right, all the merit, unless you have dedicated it all the time in between. So, yeah, then you know, we have in the four seals, we have this first line, Satchitam Chidumava, all contaminated things are miserable, unsatisfactory. So, in this connection, I think, with how desire is increasing, it's important to understand what it means that phenomena are contaminated or literally connected with the steam of affliction or desire, mainly desire. So we have a definition for contaminated objects, and it's roughly speaking something like an object that is suitable or destined for increasing afflictions, especially desire in our mind. This means when our mind touches the object, we tend to exaggerate the qualities, the positive qualities it has. Yeah, we don't see the objects really as they are. You know, so the problem is not of eating some food that tastes good. You know, you don't need to put a lot of salt in your soup to be a good Buddhist, you know, so that to make sure that you will not enjoy it. Yeah, so, I mean, it's the point is just that you shouldn't exaggerate, you should just see it as it is, something that makes you doing your practice well, you need to continue your body, yeah, your health, and then for sure you better eat healthy things than unhealthy things, but from time to time you can also eat something else, but whatever comes into your alms bowls you are supposed to eat, right? So you shouldn't take too much care. My teacher said he sometimes has the feeling that people in the West try to eat such healthy food that they may become 300 years old, but that's not necessary. You only know. We have only a certain period of time so to survive, so we shouldn't overdo it. Yeah? But the point is that we usually, I mean, desire arises because we think that there are more qualities in the object of our attraction than there are. And this is why the desire increases. And this you find only with these contaminated objects. But this is the only, we don't have uncontaminated objects. As long as you haven't achieved this path of seeing, yeah, all the objects you get in touch with are contaminated. And they arise from our karma, which is also contaminated, and also our five aggregates we have are contaminated, yeah. And so they, you know, that is why, I mean, you may feel happy and think this is real happiness, but we know why it's not real happiness, because we can have tooth pain in the next hour, yeah. You can heavily get sick. I mean, you always have this potentially suffering within you. You never know what comes in the next moment. I mean, I heard about two persons. One lady told me she went on a walk with somebody, and suddenly there were three persons. One person was somehow leaving behind, and they were turning around, and she was young, healthy, and she was lying dead on the earth, you know, just during a walk. And another one, I mean, one man called me. He was a doctor who was working in an emergency section, and he went with his wife on holiday. And they wanted to return, went to the airport, and on the way to the airplane, suddenly she collapsed and she was dead. And he was a doctor of emergency, you know, organizing this really huge emergency cases, you know, like you had here in the US on 11/9, you know, and 9/11. So, and I mean, he couldn't do anything, just dead. Young, nice woman, you know, no disease, nothing. So this can happen to us every moment. So there's no security in samsara as long as we have this contaminated aggregates. We never know what's coming in the next moment. And thus in the Lamrim, it's explained that, as I mentioned before, renunciation is the attitude of a person of medium capacity. And there's a nice verse from the Lama Tripa Lamrim prayer on this. May I read this to you? How's my time? Left. Violently tossed at mid. Let's try it again. My English is really, you know, not as difficult for me. Violently tossed amidst waves of disturbing attitudes and karma, plagued by hordes of sea monsters, the three kinds of suffering, we seek your inspiration to develop an intense longing to be free from this monstrous ocean of boundless and vicious existence. Having abandoned the mind that views this unbearable prison of cyclic existence as a pleasure grove, we seek your inspiration to partake of the treasures of Arya's jewels and the three trainings, and thus to uphold liberation's banner. And in Lama Tsongkhapa's Foundation of All Good Qualities, it says, the fluctuation of our body and life is like a bubble of water. Remember death, for we perish so quickly. After death, the effects of black and white karma pursue us as a shadow follows a body. Finding certainty in this, I request inspiration to always be careful to abandon even the slightest negative action and to complete the accumulation of merit. There is no satisfaction in enjoying worldly pleasures. They are the door to all misery. Having realized that the fault of samsaric perfections is that they cannot be trusted, I request inspiration to be strongly intent on the bliss of liberation. That pure thought to attain liberation, renunciation, produces great conscientiousness. Consciousness, mindfulness and awareness. I request inspiration to make the essential practice keeping the vows of individual liberation the root of the doctrine. And in the summary of the Bhikshu Pratimoksha Sutra, it is said, not to do any non-virtue, to practice virtue perfectly, to completely subdue one's own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So this is a summarizing of the whole Buddha's teaching to make it very easy. Not to do any non-virtue, to practice virtue perfectly, to completely subdue one's own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So this means you just watch all your time, your mind, and try to direct it into a positive direction with good motivation. And this is practice of Dhamma. Actually quite easy, isn't it? Just avoid the negative and do the positive. That's you can do as a lay or as a monastic. Most important is your motivation. And good discipline is a very stable foundation. And if you don't have this, there's really the danger that you fall back again into your habits, into your old patterns, you know, because you're so much used to the way you were living for many years. So our mind got, habituated to all these negative patterns also, you know, the old, all these bad habits we have, and I mean it's really difficult to get rid of it. And for this I think monastic community is something really helpful, because you can encourage each other to practice. It's much easier than if you're alone with all the people around you who tell you all the time, that you are quite crazy trying to stay away from alcohol and these kind of things, and you better enjoy with them, and you come with them to party, and you smoke with them, and you go for some holidays and so on, and they try to convince you all the time that what you are doing is quite stupid, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember this when I was in school again, and when I decided the day when I decided to become a nun, because I mean they all tried to convince me again to go for a party, and I had decided I don't want to, you know, and then suddenly I was staying again with them and smoking a cigarette, and I had given up for 1 year. And then I thought, what am I doing here again? No, I don't want to do this any longer. So then I went to a coffee and wrote a diary, quite long, many hours. And then finally it said in the diary, well, the best thing would be I should become a nun. And then I thought, well, don't exaggerate, that's a little bit too much. And then I tried for another hour to debate it. You know? But then when it was getting dark, I felt, no, this is really what I want to do. And I don't care any longer what my parents say and what my family will say, because at the time of death, I have to say myself whether I have used my life in a way I really feel it's the good way to do it. And then who helps me from all these other people, you know? Then it's only me and what I have done. And then it should be the right thing I have done. So then I went to my teacher and told him I want to become a nun. Straight away. So I think when you become a monastic, it's very important to get initially a very good training, sound training. I know that in our Tibetan tradition, and this is only possible in the Tibetan tradition, there is some kind of thing happening in the West that people just meet some lama who is traveling and say, well, I would like to become a monastic, can you please give me the precepts of a monastic? And then they say, oh yes, sure, you come tomorrow morning, I will give you. And then they just return to their daily routine, you know. And they just stay on their own and nothing is changing in their life. They just continue to stay there as it is. And I mean, this is quite painful. Because, I mean, how can you become a monastic if nobody is telling you what it means to be a monastic and how to live as a monastic? And, I mean, you have to get first proper training. So, I mean, you really have to make sure that you find a good senior monastic who is qualified herself or himself to train you. And then stay, usually the tradition is you stay at least 10 years. And there are some exceptions, 5 years, but usually the tradition is 10 years. You should really get your thorough training. And I mean, we had already mentioned that the mind before ordination and after ordination is almost the same, right? You don't instantly change on a higher level somewhere, but I mean, you may have changed your outfit, you have the shaved head and you are wearing the robes and so on. And this is helpful, it's a kind of protection. But I mean, then if you need to go to work and take it off again and go again like a lay person, and I mean, you will not be happy, I can tell you, really. I have seen so many monks and nuns coming and going. It really does not last. I mean, you have to do it properly and make sure that you get into the right conditions first. And I mean, I was lucky. Somebody at our center, the president, said, I'm going to pay your rent and you can have food here in the center with a gishe. And so, I mean, from the time I became ordained onwards, I was not staying overnight in the center, but I had a room close by and I stayed all the day in the center. And I mean, so I could work all the time in the center. This was nice, but also difficult because there was no nuns community. So then afterwards the monks community was growing and I had to wait 7 more years until the next nun came. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I felt really lonely. So it's good to have also other nuns you can exchange with, you know, and it's very helpful. So, and then after you have received all your training, then you can choose whatever you want to do. You can do a long-term retreat, like a three-year retreat, or you can get more socially engaged and really try to bring the Dharma into society. Or you can become a teacher and train others, or you can do like I'm doing now, become a scholar and learn Tibetan, do translation and research. So there are many options how you can serve the Dharma. And most important is the attitude, and to find a balance between the study, meditation and work. Or community service, however you call it. I think it's very important to get balanced, because if you, for example, I really speak now from my experience, you know, I mean, I was always quite a hard worker, so I was very much used to do a lot of work, but then if you don't give yourself in between the time for meditation and only study and work, but not much of meditation, then what you have studied is not really getting deep into your mind, you know, and then in the daily situations you just behave as you always behaved, you know. I mean, there is no real transformation. So it's really very important to have all three things studied, so that you know how to meditate, yeah, and then the meditation to really make your mind one with what you have, I mean, mm-hmm. what do you say, that you integrate it, yeah, so that it really becomes part of your mind, yeah, all the virtues you have studied about, to make sure it's really getting inseparable from your own mind, and then also serve again the community and test yourself how much you have really achieved. Mm-hmm. You know, my teacher said you can see how far you have come with your training of the mind when you test yourself in a difficult situation. If on a Sunday when you have holiday and you are relaxed at home, you can develop compassion in a nice way, this is no big surprise, right? Because everybody can always do on a holiday. But then, I mean, if you come really into a very difficult situation and you still can develop compassion, this means you have really made some progress. So you have always to test your progress, and if you stay on your own and you don't meet other people much, you don't know how far you reached. But if you meet people and you have to work with them and have to get along with them, then see how well your practice is going. So I think a good balanced mixture is good. And I think we are also at a time when monastics should also think about how they can serve society. You know, I wanted to show you on my way to Vancouver. I found this at a kiosk, yeah. A Canadian magazine. I don't know whether it's a good one or not. Zuma. And this issue is called the happiness issue, with the holding of the Dalai Lama on the front page. And he is giving an interview there on his 5 steps to inner peace. And there's one sentence I wanted to share with you. I really liked it. Where is it? Just give me a point. I think it's getting more and more important nowadays. He says, "We do not need to become religious, nor do we need to believe in ideology. All that is necessary is for each of us to develop our good human qualities." You know, I mean, this is for a broader public, I'm aware of it. But I think we really have to think nowadays also about how can we benefit other people with the Dharma without trying to make them Buddhist. Yeah, and I heard you have now this nice project in Spokane on compassion, mm-hmm. and already 60-70 people who really want to work something on compassion, you know, and I think these kind of initiatives and also the work you are doing with the prisoners is just wonderful. I really rejoice in this. I mean, these are, yeah, again, very good role models for development of Buddhism in the West. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much for your attention. Are there any questions? Sorry, I spoke a little bit too long, perhaps. When are we going to finish? 5:30 or 5:45? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And we have 10 minutes for either meditation or questions. What do you like? Yeah?
I wondered if you could talk about your teacher a little bit.
My teacher? Thanks for giving me the opportunity. Well, I had a wonderful teacher, I must say. He always stressed that he's a very simple geisha. He had no relatives, no rich background, therefore also not many disciples in his monasteries. He only got many disciples when he came to the West, because his teacher asked him to go to the West. And since he didn't know the language, he first thought that he will be sent to Japan, and only when he arrived he noticed it's not Japan but Germany. And he was hoping that it's only for a year or something like this, and then he can return. So he had just finished his Larampa Geshe, and he was planning to go to the Tantra College, but he had to go and get close with us. And our center is under the patronage of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and this was up to the end of his life his foremost teacher. So he really wanted to do everything in a way that it would please His Holiness the Dalai Lama, so he very carefully listened to all his talks and how he wants to have things done, and he tried to make it exactly in the way as His Holiness has explained it. And I think due to this intention of him, and also he was asked to take over leadership of the center, and he said, no, it's too early, how can I take over the leadership? I don't know your language, I don't know your culture, so I cannot really be in charge. Give me some years and then we will see. When I'm still here, perhaps I can do it more, but for the time being I can't. So he was quite humble, and yeah, I mean, we had very good translators in the beginning, like, for example, Stephen Batchelor, Aaron Wallace was translating the first course, and then Stephen Batchelor was staying for 1 year, and then Brian Gravier came for a year, and they were all fluent in Tibetan. We had translations from Tibetan into English, into German. And sometimes there were more teachers and translators than students listening to the teachings. But I mean, we had this wonderful opportunity, therefore, to get really a lot of personal training, you know. And I think our teacher also learned from us in a way. He was very interested in our culture. He was very much interested in interfaith dialogue. So he was all the time, he had a very open mind to learn also himself. Mm-hmm. And I think we had a really good exchange. And he started, I mean, he gave a lot of teachings, and then he first tried with the traditional way of doing things, with teaching us the Temi. You know, we had every day, we had debate and learning Tibetan and learning all the definitions by heart. And so he didn't know German and we didn't know Tibetan, but still we debated together in Tibetan. I don't know how we have done it, but it worked. But then it became obvious that it was very difficult to set up a monastery, because there was no real support, and there were more lay people who were interested, and so it became more and more a place for lay people to study. And in 1988, I think this was his biggest achievement, he established a 7-year study program for people who have to go to work and who don't know Tibetan, comprising the whole Geshe studies in 7 years. So he worked really hard on this, and now in September the 9th course is starting, and already about more than 1,000 people have participated in this program, becoming more and more also teachers and giving talks on Buddhism and helping now also as assistant teachers and tutors. And I think this is really a great opportunity we have. And I mean, unfortunately, you know, in 2002 he was planning to do a 3-year retreat, and he had prepared everything for going into retreat for 3 years. And then suddenly cancer was diagnosed, and he passed away within 7 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But his passing away was in a way like, I really felt it was like Buddha was passing away, you know. I have never seen, and my mother passed away from cancer 1 year later. And I mean, you really saw the big difference Dharma makes at the time of death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he learned that there's really nothing you can do about the disease, and also no chemotherapy or anything, and he's just going to die, and the doctors knew that he is in a very responsible position, so they said he really has to get things done soon because he will become very weak and then will be no longer able to do much, so he has to use the next 1 or 2 weeks to arrange everything. And so then he did this, and then we got into our meditation house in Kling outside the city. And then I remember he gave me his calendar, and he said, this we don't need any longer, right? So put it away. And then I wanted to put it a little bit close so that he could still reach it. And I said, no, put it away. I don't need any longer. Now it's done. So he could really make his peace with it, you know. And he just knew now is the time, and he didn't regret. And I remember one time in between, when he was seriously sick, he had some stomach bleeding in 1983 after we had started our new house, when we had just bought the house and it had been consecrated. And the next day he had to go to the hospital, and then after some time in the emergency section, then one day a whole bunch of doctors came, and the main doctor told him, you know, well, now about your stomach, it's fine, it's okay, but we have eczema in you, and well, you have also some, I don't know how to say this in German, it's hematomas in, close to the liver,
mm-hmm.
And when you get bumped, like in an accident or something like this, you know, then it can open, and then you may die on the spot, and there's nothing we can do on this. And so this means you can die every moment. And then he started laughing and laughing, clapping his hands and laughing, and the doctors were all very astonished. And then they felt there must be some mistranslation. And I said, why is he laughing? What did you translate? And then we asked him why he's laughing. And then he felt, well, he just feels so amused because he's actually the one who should tell them as a Buddhist teacher that you can die every moment. They are telling him. Then he said, yes, I know. So from such small moments, you know, you could really see the realizations he had. I mean, he had really, I'm pretty sure he had come quite deep and far on his path. And I think he had something more urgent to do somewhere else. Therefore he left.
So for the last 2 weeks of his life, was he able to just be quiet and be do his
yes.
practice and just...
Yes. Except one time we had to go to the hospital again, and they said, well, perhaps better now to stay here. And he felt also that the people at the hospital were taking care of him very nice, but he preferred to return to our meditation house. And then he had some people, some monks, to geishas, to do the recitation of his daily prayers, because he was too weak to do this all on his own. So he knew them by heart, but he asked them to recite them for him so that it's easier for him to remember. And then the night before he passed away, he had again some bleeding. And his translator, Christoph, who had been a monk for a long time, and myself, I mean, we were his closest disciple. So we were sitting right and left of him in that night, and we had called the doctor, who was also a student of him, but he took about an hour to come there. but he came immediately. And so during this time, he gave us some really profound teachings on emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then he was okay again, and he said, well, I think we should sleep now a little bit more, isn't it? And then the doctor said, you're sure you can do this? I said, yes, yes. What else should we do at this time? It's quite early still. So then we went back again to our rooms, and then early in the morning it was clear that now he's going to pass away. So he asked me to call the two geishas, and then he was taking self-initiation into Yamantaka again. And then when the self-initiation was finished, then he said something like, now everything is done. And then somebody asked me to cover him with his chuga. And then he asked, is there anything else you want to say? And then he just passed away. Yeah. And it's I mean, it's actually the perfect way of dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, I think I was traumatized. For me, it was just too hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was the most difficult thing I ever experienced in my life. What to do, but that's the way how things are going, and I think it's a very good and important experience to understand that even the Buddha, I mean, this is what I understood at that time, you know, that even the Buddha has to pass away. Even your teachers, I mean, they have reached so far and still they have to pass away. And so for us there's also no escape, right? The time will come, and the only thing that will help us then is the Dharma. It's really true. We never know when it's going to come. But it certainly will come. Yeah, thank you so much.